Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We do tabulate these data by region, and also for the largest producing states, we also produce some state-level statistics.
Administrator of the National Ag Statistics Service, Joe Parsons.
In the Midwest region, think Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, that region accounts for 31% of U.S. total production expenditures, with just over $150 billion, and that's up 4.6% from 2022. As far as states go, the largest state expenditure is in California, and they contributed the most to the 2023 total at $52.7 billion. And it should be said that the California production expenditures are up nearly 15% from 2022. Iowa, which is the next largest state in terms of farm production expenditures, had almost $38 billion in farm production expenses.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I want to make a brief statement on something that is admittedly not within the scope of this particular hearing, but is very important to my district and agriculture producers across the country.
Nebraska Representative Mike Flood addressing Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
With the 45Z clean fuel production credit going into effect in less than 5 months, Nebraska's agriculture and energy producers need full and accurate guidance promptly. I was disappointed to see Treasury release guidance in April for the 40B sustainable aviation fuel credit that rejected the best available scientific data and tied the hands of our nation's ag producers with an unworkable one-size-fits-all limitation. Nebraska's farmers don't need the federal government to come in at the 11th hour and dictate which practices are acceptable and not acceptable, and I will continue to advocate for greater flexibility that fully recognizes the role Nebraska's producers play in the future of transportation fuels and for an all-of-the-above energy policy that puts our farmers first.
We move from Treasury now to the Fed, where Oklahoma Representative Frank Lucas addressing Fed Chairman Jerome Powell.
The 2024 stress test focused on commercial real estate risk, which is an area we've all been paying close attention to here on this committee. Do you agree that the results showed the financial system to be strong?
Yes, I do.
The folks back home are always very concerned about inflation and the period we've gone through lately, not just the basic necessities that continue to explode, but the cost of doing business and all those other issues. Fact is, the inflation's still running above the Fed's 2% target, and we've seen significant price increases in food and energy over recent years. And as you and I have discussed before, I started out as a young farmer in 1977 in that inflationary period during the Carter years, and then when we went through Chairman Volcker's rather, shall we say, dramatic tightening of monetary policy. And I still remember paying 17% to borrow cow feed money when I was a student in college. I was well collateralized, but that was a bargain in the fact that the capital's accessible. So I'm particularly sensitive, being a part of that generation, that if inflation isn't effectively dealt with, it can spiral out of control. Could you expand for a little bit more about your approach in dealing with inflation in a way that doesn't repeat the mistakes of the past? I just want to avoid the mistakes of the past.
So I think really, one of the big lessons coming out of the high inflation of the 70s, which we both lived through, is that it really is on the central bank to be on the case and do the job and make sure that it is fully, well and truly done. And that really that is up to the central bank. And believe it or not, that wasn't fully accepted or that wasn't necessarily the thinking. And also, the independence of central banks was much less respected back then. All the more credit to Paul Volcker for having the courage to do it. So that is an internalized lesson for people in central banking these days. We do understand that. We are committed to bringing inflation sustainably down to 2%.
One last question in my remaining seconds. You and the leadership of the feds will be there the day before the election this fall, and you'll be there the day after the election. Still be the same people carefully watching the feds' responsibilities, correct?
This is my fourth presidential election at the Fed, and I can tell you, we come to work the next day and we do our jobs.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We'll have lower incomes, and farmers will likely use financial reserves that they built from the 21 and 22 period.
University of Illinois ag economist Gary Schnitke.
So those financial reserves will be used, and we will enter into a lower period of returns. That, in turn, will put downward pressures on returns. And prices could also face downward pressure, but it's likely that they'll hang in there or maybe decline slightly. Overall, we're back to the 2015 through 2019 period, similar to that moving forward. And we've seen these before in agriculture, and we again likely are in a lower return period.
So things are going to get tough, but Brad Lubin, associate professor and extension policy specialist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, talks about a recent Supreme Court decision on Chevron deference and Farm Bill.
Economists should not pretend to be lawyers. Lawyers should not pretend to be economists. I'm an economist with a focus on policy development. I can't say for sure how the Chevron doctrine or the absence of a Chevron doctrine will specifically drive particularly legal questions from here on out. But if I imagine that it means the interpretation of legislation is more critical and the deference to federal agencies is gone, so trying to determine what legislation means and trying to determine who gets to decide what it means is a much more challenging question. What that suggests is that writers on Capitol Hill have to be much more specific and much more clear about what's intended, both within the statutory language as well as maybe the conference report and instructions that go along with the language. Federal agencies still have to be careful about interpreting that language and determining what intent or what's reasonable given the language that is sometimes ambiguous. And then courts still have to ultimately interpret that and gauge the legality of it. But go back to the first case up on Capitol Hill, it probably means that future legislation has to be more specific and more detailed to ensure that the language and the instructions or the intent are clearly spelled out. That's often a challenge. Well, number one, it's more extensive and maybe takes more time. It also can disrupt the political process, whereas sometimes policy moves very, very quickly, and it's most efficient to write language that effectively says the federal agency has the authority and the expectation to implement programs as needed to address this issue, like a disaster, for example. The money might be needed very, very fairly urgently. The language might be written in 2 days and move through Congress in short order. I wouldn't expect Congress to be sitting down long enough to write the exact specifics of how it should be implemented. That's where discretion is really going to be still expected and required from the federal agency. On the other hand, there could be longstanding debates like a major authorizing bill, like a farm bill, where we fight over I's and T's. Sometimes it's easier to come to a consensus if we can agree that slightly ambiguous language means what we think it means, and then defer it to the federal agency to actually go about the task of writing the rule. Well, if we have uncertainty about what can be interpreted or not interpreted through the rulemaking process, that makes the lawmaking process that much more difficult.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's almost to the point where nobody really knows my real name.
His real name is Scott Shalady, but on TV, he's known as the Cow Guy.
And I'm actually the second one. My father was the first cow guy. He started wearing a black and white Holstein jacket in the corn pit in Chicago, probably in the late 1970s. So he had it for a while, and then he retired in 2001, and that was about the time I came back from my first stint in London. I was in London for 16 years, 12 my first one and 4 my second tour. But when I came back, I thought, you know what? If he retires, I'll wear it. And I started wearing it. And one thing led to another, and it caught on. And I had been doing TV up until then, but not wearing the cow jacket. So when I put that thing on, it attracted some attention. And so when the money came into our markets, I don't know if anybody really remembers, but hedge funds really began to play a big role in our markets, commodity markets, I say, because I've dealt in, and there's only really three markets you can trade in. There's derivatives off of all of them, obviously, but you can trade the agricultural, you know, commodities, you can trade interest rates, and you can trade the equities. Those are the three main things. And the funds have been, the hedge funds and Wall Street money and international money have been obviously very, very active in interest rates and equities. But it wasn't until about 2001 that they started to really dip their toes into the commodities markets. And that coincided with me coming back from London and my dad retiring and me putting on the jacket and kind of everything kind of all came together at once. And so with that jacket and the money that was coming in from across the world with the hedge funds, and then at the same time the media aspect, it kind of all, I call myself the accidental commentator. I didn't really mean for it all to happen, but it did.
He hosts a show called The Cow Guy Close on RFD TV.
We have a family farm, and you know, I don't want to, you know, RFD TV obviously is a rural agricultural television channel, and we do 5 hours of market day report before my show comes on. I don't want to teach farmers how to farm. I think that you know, we had a farm. We have brokers that would come around and try to teach us how to farm from Chicago, and they didn't realize my dad and I still traded in the pits. And so it's not my business to tell people how to farm or tell people how to ranch. They should probably have a pretty good idea about that if they've been doing it for a while. But what I'd like to do is help them take the money they make from that and make more money with it, right? Invest that money. And so we came up with the idea for a show at RFD TV that was more financially centered rather than agriculturally centered. We talk about agriculture obviously on the show, but it's more or less what are you going to do with the money you make from your day job, which is ag or ranching? And it's really caught it struck a nerve in a good way. And so we've got a lot of people watching it. It's the number one live show on the network, and our numbers annually are still increasing at a great pace. So it's a lot of fun, but it's a little bit different than standing in a pit. But at the same time, it's not. There's an adrenaline rush. You know, there's preparation. It's a lot like, I mean, even athletics, you know, so I really enjoy it. And you know, getting out and about and pressing the flesh like I just did up in Indianapolis over the last few days has been fantastic that way. But you know, I enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. I've always wanted to do it too. And I always kind of had my eye on that. And I always knew that at some point in time, when I traded in London, for 16 years, about halfway through that, I saw they moved electronic way before the US did. And that's when I had kind of a little bit of a heads up that you might want to feather the nest here and make sure you've got another foot on another lily pad, because this is not going to be around forever. And that's when I started to make that transition, because I was getting a lot of hits and a lot of airtime anyway. And so I thought, maybe if I could make this into a full-time gig, that would be what I wanted to do. So I love it. So it's not really even a job. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, I look forward to going in every day.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In my personal life, I get really tired of getting gonged at all the time because I left the key in the ignition, or I'm driving around my fields there and I don't have my seatbelt on because I'm jumping in and out and irrigating, and you can't shut the damn things off.
A rice farmer from California is a member of the House Ag Committee and House Transportation Committee, Doug LaMalfa.
The dealer says, oh, it's a safety thing. Like, well, you know, I have enough of a brain to figure out when I can do it safely or not. But we're not given that credit, and especially as truckers who put in lots of miles, many, many miles as professionals. So more and more things are being done to take away their discretion and their ability, especially mom-and-pop truckers that are maybe not covering the vast majority of miles or hours doing so. So we're talking about automatic emergency braking systems, the speed limiters we talked about, ELDs, which are not very highly favored by the smaller truckers, and then truck shutoff devices that automatically shut the truck off after reaching hours of service limits. Now, nothing mankind makes is perfect, and so these systems can all glitch. I have to wonder about, you know, and we're seeing this on automobiles, cars and pickups, that they glitch, and you got automatic braking if it detects you're too close to another car, and so you're driving along and the car's jerking on you, trying to do things automatically for you. And, you know, people aren't perfect, but neither are the devices. So, Mr. Pugh, talk about in a scenario I've heard about is that with the automatic emergency braking systems, what if you're driving an 80,000-pound rig in an icy condition and something detects that we need to jam on the brakes? What does that do to upset the control of the truck in that situation, or others that you know of that you can tell the committee here today?
Louis Pugh is Executive Vice President of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association.
In short, it'll put you into a skid if you're not real careful or don't know what you're doing. That's where I point out the fact, as I said earlier, cars are much different than trucks. Trucks way longer. It's 65, 70 feet long. The tires are bigger. Where the wheels, the tires are at on the road at the time, then you add in the different kinds of loads. If you're hauling a low load, a piece of some pipe or something, it doesn't stick very high on your trailer. You have a lower center of gravity. That handle is completely different if you're hiring a giant single coil that weighs 50,000 pounds and 6 feet tall, but only 4 feet wide. You're very high center of gravity. It's easy to tip. Put liquid into the mix. If you pull a tanker, I pulled a tanker for a little bit. I jokingly said it felt like you're on a boat all the time because as you're going down the highway, that stuff's in there sloshing. Now, you're on an icy road, and you hit the brakes, or they automatically just lock up, and that chemical or something that's in that tanker comes forward, it's going to put you in a heck of a situation. You're going to be passing yourself.
The trucker's thinking about that load as he's going, whereas the automatic device just wants to be automatic, right?
And in my opinion, as a trained trucker, and this is what we should be looking at, is training truckers instead of coming out with all kinds of electronic devices to dumb down the industry. Let's train the people behind the wheel to drive the truck. I hauled frac sand for a long time down West Virginia in the mountains. You have to know what you're doing to drive off-road and go up the side of a mountain. I mean, I was pulled up the side of a mountain with a dozer. It was so steep. You can't make computers, in my opinion, that can do these kind of things. And you know what? We all forget, and you said it yourself, Congressman, computers have bad days, too. I can't get my freaking phone to sync to my 2022 Ford pickup truck half the time. Now, I think that's pretty basic technology, but it doesn't work a lot. But now we want to put all these things into trucks and say, hey, you're safer now. We teach pilots to fly the plane before we teach them to fly the plane with all the technology.
Well, we have an issue with the 737s that they had too much gadgetry on there they're relying on instead of the pilot knowing how to fly the plane.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, it unfortunately is really, really spotty.
Travis Myers is a producer from O'Donnell, Texas, and a member of Cotton Incorporated.
There have been areas that have gotten some really good rains in the last 2 to 3 weeks, you know, and their crops are doing well. Irrigated cotton is doing well. It could sure use some help right now, but our dry land crops for the most part are in trouble. We've got a big heavy fruit load on them, and they need more water than they're getting. So we desperately need a rain, cover lots of country kind of rain, you know, in the next 10 days or so to complete this crop.
And as we approach the end of the season, how can you tell that cotton is finished growing?
It's all about the flowering and the blooms as they work up the plant, you know, and when that flower gets to the top of the plant, well, it's basically through. It will continue to fill out the stuff below it. But right now we've got, what we call white flags waving in the wind, you know, on top of this smaller cotton that doesn't need to be through at this point. You know, we still need to be making cotton and without the moisture, it's just not going to allow it to do that.
Those are some challenges he faces. What do other producers face?
It's been pretty interesting. The guys from South Texas, you know, that are basically our neighbors, you know, have luckily escaped this last hurricane that came down through there, you know, and so they're right in the middle of their harvest right now, and just, you know, they're praying for good open weather. And of course, we're sitting up there in West Texas hoping for a hurricane that might push some moisture up to us, you know. But anyway, they've got a good crop down there, and they just need time to get it out. Just had lunch today with a bunch of guys from North and South Carolina, you know, and they're scared to death because they're expected to get between 10 and 20 inches of rain in the next 2 or 3 days from Hurricane Debbie. So they're kind of on pins and needles, you know, because they've got a really good crop in the field. But, you know, 20 inches changes a lot of things for nearly anybody.
But despite all of the challenges, he still remains optimistic about the future.
Cotton's been good to me and my family for a lot of years, you know, and I know other parts of the country, they have lots of options, you know, but there in West Texas, we don't have a lot of other options that will actually cash flow. And so we, we've just got to try to make this cotton deal work for us and get more people wearing cotton and more people using cotton and find new uses for cotton. And, you know, there's breakthroughs in the insulation and this cellulose, turning this cotton into sugar and using it for lots of different things. And so there's lots of good things happening. You know, unfortunately, this price is just horrible right now due to the economy and overseas demand, but it'll come back, and we just have to ride out the tough times.
But a new class of leaders have to rise up.
I just think it's crucial to our industry. You know, we've just seems like a lot of the younger people have just gotten away from volunteering for things like this and stuff. But just having our say and getting to meet these other people from different parts of the world and just being a part of this promotion and getting to hear about a lot of the new stuff that's going on, it's very rewarding.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Social Security does not add to the U.S. debt, technically, but the paying back the money that was borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund does.
Representative David Schweikert from Arizona is one of the toughest budget hawks in Congress.
So there's some $3 trillion that have been borrowed out. And for the last few years, every month, there's not enough tax collections coming in on the FICA tax, that 12.4%, to make the payments to Social Security recipients. So every month, I want you just to visualize this. Social Security says, hey, Treasury, I'm holding a bunch of your bonds. You owe us some money. And they cash them in, and Treasury goes and borrows money and pays interest for that borrowed money. So Social Security doesn't create the debt, but Treasury does, because Treasury has to go out and borrow money to pay back the money they've taken out of the Social Security Trust Fund. And if you add it all up, plus interest, and forgive me, I'm partially doing this off the top of my head, I calculate maybe $6 trillion, three plus in principal, and then over the time the interest paid back, it's probably another three. How many times have you had anyone just try to be honest about it? It's not Republican math. It's not Democrat math. It's just math to be avoided because we're terrified of our voters to tell them the truth because we've lied to them for so long. How many times have you had a Democrat go around here saying, if we just tax rich people more? I've done entire presentations here. And for those on the Republican side, if we just cut discretionary spending, well, damn it, I can come up with about $300 billion in discretionary can be cut. Now, they'll be screaming, but that's still 1% of GDP. And for the Democrats, every tax hike they genuinely propose that could be executed when you adjust it for its economic effects would be about 1.5% of GDP. So you got 1.5% there on tax hikes. You got 1% cuts over here. Hey, it's a big 2.5%, right? Right? 2.5%. We're borrowing 7% of the entire economy this year. Great job, guys. And I guess part of my anger is I love some of the people I work with here. They're smart. They care. But they run away from me when they see me coming because I want to talk about this stuff. This chart is the pie chart of America's spending. Do you see this number? 74% is in the red. The red doesn't get a vote from a member of Congress. That is on autopilot. It's called mandatory. It's earned benefits. Some of the benefits you get because you're part of a certain tribal group or you fall below a certain income, but this is earned. You see the blue? It's defense and non-defense. Every dime of defense is borrowed. Every dime of what we call non-defense discretionary is borrowed. And a wedge of this over here is borrowed. And when you see over here, when we say net interest, I've tried to explain the net difference between net interest and gross interest. Net interest this year will be $892 billion. That's interest we pay to people out in the world. Your pension fund, a nice family on the other side of the world, the union retirement fund over here. They buy U.S. debt. The other debt is we owe to the trust funds. We've borrowed the money from the trust funds, but we still have to pay it back. We still have to pay it interest. It's one of the great cons we do in our budgeting here. Is, well, its gross interest is only $890 billion, Schweikert. Why do you keep going around saying $1.2 trillion interest just this year? It's because that other chunk of interest, we got to pay. And we're going to have to pay back the principal, just as I just did the explanation on how Social Security works. So once again, if you're a member of Congress and you're doing a town hall or putting out something and you're not showing this chart, you're not helping our brothers and sisters across the country understand how serious this election is.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Lower topsoil moisture ratings now reflecting seasonal highs. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says U.S. topsoil moisture rated very short to short for the period ending August 4th.
Currently, short to very short ratings, 35%. That is up 3 points from last week, and that actually represents the highest number that we have seen this year so far. And it's the highest number for topsoil moisture rated very short to short since the final week of the 2023 season.
Drier conditions in the west and central U.S. are behind the deteriorating topsoil moisture conditions on a countrywide level.
The wet side, well, at least until this week, not a whole lot of wetness to talk about. Surplus numbers at 7% nationally. That is likely to change in states like Georgia and the Carolinas, but that's news for next week.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.